from WJFF.
From the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, millions in undocumented deposits and claims of a political witch hunt. The town of Highland's final audit of the town clerk's office is raising big questions. We talk with the River Reporter's news editor, Liam Mayo, about what it found, what's next, and why it matters. From fresh ideas and big changes in his first 50 days to the future of tourism in the region, Michael Martelon, the new CEO of the Sullivan County Visitors Association, joins us to share his vision for the Catskills. And for 45 years, the Catskill Exotic Bird Club has flocked together bird lovers from across the region. Now, as more species face extinction, the club is spreading its wings in a new direction. And the final August performances at Harmony in the Woods. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump says he's planning for a meeting between Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and Russian President Vladimir Putin in order to end the war in Ukraine. Trump met the Ukrainian leader at the White House yesterday and then held a meeting with several other European leaders. Trump told Fox News this morning that both Zelensky and Putin will have to reach agreement to end the war.
I think Putin is tired of it. I think they're all tired of it. But you never know. We're going to find out about President Putin in the next couple of weeks, that I can tell you. And we're going to see where it all goes. It's possible that he doesn't want to make a deal.
Trump says the U.S. will assist Ukraine with security guarantees, but the White House has not said what these guarantees might be for Ukraine. The chair of the House Oversight Committee, James Comer, says the Justice Department will comply with a subpoena. It's for files related to late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Deirdre Walsh has more.
The oversight panel voted last month to subpoena the unredacted Justice Department files related to Jeffrey Epstein. The disgraced financier and convicted sex offender was charged with sex trafficking in 2019. The committee set an August 19th deadline, but Comer says DOJ has agreed to begin sending documents starting this Friday. He noted there are many records and it will take some time to send them all. Names of victims and child sex abuse material will be redacted. The panel held a closed-door interview with former Attorney General Bill Barr and subpoenaed others, including former President Clinton, for interviews. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News.
Stocks opened mixed this morning as the Commerce Department reported a pickup in home building activity last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 180 points in early trading.
Builders broke ground on 5.2% more homes in July than they did the month before. Construction of single-family homes jumped nearly 3% last month. Building permits, which are considered a guide to future construction plans, offered a more mixed picture. Permits for single-family homes rose slightly last month, while permits for multifamily housing fell. A survey shows many home builders are still gloomy about the housing market, with elevated mortgage rates keeping a lot of would-be buyers on the sidelines. Home Depot says its sales picked up in the most recent quarter, but the home improvement chain's sales and profits still fell short of what analysts had expected. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Forecasters say that Hurricane Erin has been downgraded to a Category 2 storm in the Atlantic Ocean. Top sustained winds are 110 miles per hour. Erin will not hit the East Coast, but it is getting bigger. Forecasters say the hurricane will still kick up life-threatening rip currents and surf along the coast. North Carolina officials have ordered some evacuations in the Outer Banks. They say flooding will be a significant issue there in coming days. This is NPR. Employees of the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. say they want to keep their right to wear masks at the Performing Arts Center. Officials banned masks earlier this year. NPR's Anastasia Tsiolkos has more.
More than 800 Kennedy Center employees and their supporters are calling on the institution to reverse its ban on masks for employees. The anti-mask policy was introduced this April by Richard Grinnell, who was appointed president of the Kennedy Center earlier this year. President Trump is its current chair. In a press release, unionized employees at the Kennedy Center say that workers have routinely been denied exemptions to the no-mask policy, including those with documented health concerns. The group also says that masked Kennedy Center employees have experienced, quote, disciplinary action, lost wages, reassignment, surveillance, and intimidation. Anastasia Tsiolkas, NPR News, New York.
U.S. Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins says her agency will stop funding solar and wind projects on productive farmland. The Trump administration has been working to quickly end government-funded renewable energy efforts. Reuters News Agency reports an Agriculture Department study finds fewer than 700 square miles of rural land was affected by wind turbines and solar farms last year. The flight attendant strike against Air Canada is over. The union and the carrier say they've reached an agreement on a tentative contract. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The town of Highland in New York has released the final version of its audit into the town clerk's office. The report highlights millions of dollars in deposits without documentation, while the clerk's legal team is calling the whole process a politically motivated witch hunt. To help us understand what's in the audit, what it means for the town, and what happens next, we're joined now by Liam Mayo, news editor of the River Reporter. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tim.
Liam, give us a quick overview. What led to this audit?
Yeah, back in February, the Highland Town Board voted to pass a couple of resolutions censuring the town clerk, Sue Hoffman, and seizing her town computer, turning it over to the New York State Police. According to the resolution where they explained that action, they stated that Susan Hoffman, town clerk, has engaged in gross negligence regarding her duties, resulting in a failure to produce and maintain critical town records dating back to 2021, thereby hindering the effective operation of town government and eroding public confidence in the integrity of the town's administration. So that was the sort of kickoff to this. And then in May, the town released kind of a preliminary version of this report. And then that has led to this final version of the report that was released this past Tuesday at a Town of Highland board meeting.
Now, the findings of the final report, do they follow those from the preliminary report, or did anything sort of change significantly?
They pretty much follow the findings from the preliminary report. There's a little bit more information added, like the preliminary report looking at 2022 and 2023 found that deposits to a specific town account exceeded recorded receipts by around $4.5 million in total. The final audit adds 2024 to that period surveyed and increases that total variance to just under $5.4 million. So it continues on in kind of the same vein, but the team conducting the report found a couple of other things as they continued on in their efforts.
Tell us more about that $5.4 million in undocumented deposits. What's missing?
Yeah, so what isn't missing is money. As of right now, there is no allegation that there are missing funds from the town's accounts. But what is missing is records and receipts documenting like where those deposits came from, which over that 3-year period adds up to around $5.3 million more in deposits to that bank account than system recorded receipts. And the reason why this is concerning, other than just, you know, the fact that good record keeping is always generally important, according to the report, there's a current inability to determine where the extra deposits come from or which taxpayers they are attributable to. And when the variance between system records and deposits is this large, it is also impossible to determine if there are missing deposits. So what they're saying is that they aren't sure where this money came from, but because there is such a large gap between the amount of money in the accounts and the number of receipts or the amount recorded in the town's receipts, it's impossible for them to say if there were missing deposits. Like, the evidence wouldn't necessarily be there to point out that money was missing.
And it sounds like there were some, just in the process of the town in some ways, of not having a very significant audit, it seems, because it was a long period where there was this variance, and then it was certainly then just discovered, but then the town has now voted to, I guess, amend that process.
Yeah, the town is going to meet in, or the town board is going to meet in September to decide kind of what exactly they're going to do in response to this. But some of the stuff recommended, or one of the things recommended to be done in the report was to rebuild, or to basically like go back through the reports and the records that have been done and take on a reconciliation process and confirm that all transactions have been appropriately recorded. So go back through those past couple of years of missing records and build that up. And one of the other things that may come out of it is changes to the way the town clerk's office operates. Some of the other things that the report found were that there were not significant procedures and policies in place in the town clerk's office to govern some of this stuff. And as well, it found that there was significant issues with timeliness as regards several parts of the town clerk's operation. So those kinds of things may be what the town ends up addressing with new policies or new procedures.
And in your report at riverreporter.com, some of those timeliness issues include making bank deposits, remitting monthly revenue to the town, and other legal filings. Also, the town board is voted to require a secondary signer for all town bank accounts, and we'll be holding a meeting on September 2nd to discuss responses to the report. Now, what's the response been from Sue Hoffman, the town clerk?
Yeah, we haven't heard specifically from the town clerk, although she has been present at these meetings where these reports are being discussed. However, during the public comment portion of the meeting that followed the release of this report, Attorney Michael McGuire spoke on her behalf. He said that, quote, "This board has taken on the personality of a vigilante rogue mob by creating the illusion of public corruption in the office of the town clerk." And he said that the report, quote, "weaponized town government against a public servant." So from his perspective, this is sort of overblown, or the allegations made in the report are weaponized and political rather than necessarily being an entirely unbiased take on what issues exist at the town clerk's office.
And the attorney McGuire said that there was no evidence of wrongdoing, and that the, quote, "smoking gun" in the report was that some, quote, "philanthropist had deposited excess money into the town's accounts." What's that about?
That I believe he's referring to the $5.4 million, basically saying, like, oh, wow, we have more money than is recorded. That's such a big problem, like being sarcastic about it. But you know, as we've previously discussed, there are some significant concerns when there is a significant portion of money in town accounts that does not have appropriate record keeping behind it.
What's the town supervisor in the town of Highland saying?
Yeah, earlier on in the investigation, he said that the goal was not to eliminate the town clerk, Sue Hoffman, but, quote, to make sure town funds and information aren't compromised. He has also previously said that these findings kind of in the preliminary report are concerning and that they will hopefully inform a more secure town of Highland moving forward. He's also said that this situation more recently is going to be a statewide investigation very soon. And early on in the process, the New York State Police were involved in seizing the town clerk's computer. So there is that sort of statewide link already present.
It seems as if the town of Highland has had some dramatic developments in the last few years? Is this just part of that, or is there something more to it? What's your take there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there is an incredibly politically charged atmosphere in the town of Highland. A couple of years ago, the town ended up eliminating its constable's department under fairly similar circumstances, where there was a report, there were allegations made of mismanagement or of improper procedures. There was a lot of kind of political back and forth about it. People got really up in arms. And I think both, or there are two things can kind of both be true, which is the findings of this report could be true in that there are need to be better procedures in place for the town clerk's office, but also that findings are happening in a very politically charged environment where the different sides of town politics are going to have their different opinions on what those findings mean or how that should be brought about.
And so I mentioned that there's a meeting that's coming up on September 2nd where they'll discuss the responses to the report. And then is there another meeting coming up after that where they will make any kind of changes?
Yeah, I believe the September 2nd meeting is the town board workshop meeting, so they would be able to discuss the report. And then the following week's meeting on the 9th would be sort of the full official meeting of the town board, where they would be able to make the kinds of changes we've been talking about in addressing this report.
Have you heard anything from the community about the reaction to this yet, or other anyone else?
We haven't heard yet that there's been a specific reaction, but one of the things that may end up having more of a reaction as we get into a couple of months from now. We saw that according to filings from the Sullivan County Board of Elections, the current deputy supervisor has filed to be on the ballot for the 2025 election for the Highland Town Clerk position. So this may end up being a campaign issue as well as a like town governance issue.
Okay. And it's an interesting development there with the deputy supervisor. Is there a conflict of interest there in terms of anything going on?
Yeah, that was what McGuire said. He claimed that, or he said that Kidney, the deputy supervisor, should recuse herself from discussing this report because of that conflict. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, he said that she would need to disclose the money the town spent on this report as a campaign donation.
Oh.
Which, again, I don't think he was being literal there. I think that was him
suggesting that
a challenger town clerk would benefit from the things made in this report.
That's Leah Mayo, the news editor from The River Reporter, talking to us about the Highland Town Board's finalized audit of the town clerk's office. You can read about that report and follow the developments in this developing story at riverreporter.com. Thank you so much, Liam.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we will be talking to the new CEO of the Sullivan County Visitors Association. We'll find out what drew him here and how he's connecting with the community with new leadership and fresh ideas. That's next. This is Radio Chatsko.
This is Latif Nasser from Radiolab. Public media organizations across the country lost our federal funding. This cut will have long-term consequences for the service we provide to you, our community, unless we are able to replace that funding with support from more of our listeners. The future of public media is in your hands. Go to this station's website to start or increase your monthly sustaining donation today.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
Duke Devlin came to Bethel, New York for the Woodstock Music and Arts Fair in 1969, and he never left.
Hi, my name is Duke Devlin. We're sitting right here at the corner of the most famous hayfield in the world, I'd probably say, next to the monument here at Bethel Woods, the site of the Woodstock Music and Art Fair.
He stayed in the community and spent decades at the site telling the Woodstock story. And now you can hear it from Duke for yourself on the Woodstock Lost and Found podcast at WJFFradio.org. Only from Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. I'm the next Freakonomics Radio. What was it like to be middle-aged in the Middle Ages?
I think one of the things that would be shocking would be probably the level of casual cruelty.
And if you could travel back 600 years, would you go?
I guess I would, yeah, because it's a much simpler life.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Michael Martelot is the new CEO of the Sullivan County Visitors Association. With over 30 years of experience in tourism, including leadership roles in places like Telluride and Santa Cruz, Michael is bringing fresh ideas and a bold vision to the Sullivan Catskills, and he's joining us live in studio now. Welcome.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I mentioned you've worked in tourism for 30 years. Talk a little bit about your early experiences and how that taught you to lead in this field of tourism.
I love that question because leading, it was really about intensely following. So my first job in tourism was a receptionist at an advertising agency in Boston. So I was at the front desk, so I'm running into staff dynamics, client relationships, vendors, and the daily operations of what was going on. So that was really something that meant a lot to me. And then my next job, so I'm the receptionist, and then I go to work for the president of the company. So I was able to watch him and how he earned trust and how he committed himself to the team. And really what struck me the most about my early years, and it ended up staying with me, is that true leadership is about commitment to the team. Like, I work for the team, not the other way around. I'm giving them the support.
And you have taken that ideology throughout your career to Telluride, as I mentioned, and Santa Cruz. What are some of those ideas that you're bringing now here to the Sullivan Catskills?
Really, I think that the biggest thing in terms of why or what, it's not so much that you're copying a style. There are 2,400 DMOs. That's what we are. We're a destination management organization. So there are 2,400 of those worldwide. There's more than 1,000 in the U.S., so it's not as much, oh, I'm going to take this idea or that idea. It is, I know how to run these organizations. Because these organizations ultimately are an agency. They're an agency for the destination. So our brand is the people in the place. So it's really, in Telluride, I think the importance of protecting the place and the character of the place was really important. And then in Santa Cruz, I saw how to marriage natural beauty with innovation and culture. So in Sullivan Catskills, building a strong professional back of the house so our team has what they need to perform, while making sure the front of the house, which is our messaging, actually is authentic and resonates with the audience that we're looking after.
What made you want to take the job and move here? Was it the sense of a new challenge after kind of bridging these gaps that you mentioned in these other locations?
It is, but it's a personal and professional. Personally, my wife is from Boston. That's where we met. She's been wanting to come back to the Northeast since we left. So that is a thing. And then professionally, you know, when I look at Sullivan Catskills, it could be the beginning of tourism in the United States. If you look, we've been welcoming visitors here for more than 200 years. So how unbelievable is it to have an opportunity to lead that type of organization?
And in your first 50 days, you're relatively new at the job. You've made some changes, though. What were some of those changes that you made, and how did you decide what to work on first?
Well, I try not to say changes. It's more an evolution.
Updates.
And really where that started, even in the interviewing process, I audit everything. So you need to look closely at the processes and the deliverables and who's working on what and what the overall architecture is. And one thing that became pretty clear to me early on was that we needed to become genuinely data-driven. And data-driven is a buzzword that everyone's using these days. And you can use it, and you can use data pieces and not be data-driven. So being data-driven is really developing an intense back-of-the-house tech stack so that in the future you're able to lean on that. And that's something that scales with the future as well.
And how do you think you'll use data and visitor information to tell this story of the Sullivan Catskills? I should note one thing, too. If you're listening, we're live, and there's some background noise that you might hear. It sounds like a low vibration. They're installing a generator outside on the other side of our studio. Normally, you wouldn't hear this, but it's a pretty big drill, and the generator will help us later down the road. So just a note to listeners, if you happen to hear something, it's not your radio. It's live happening outside right now. But, Michael, again, how do you think you'll use data to tell that story of the Sullivan Catskills?
And it's not my stomach either. I actually really don't see data as something that tells our story. The story generates from the countless stories and the history and the culture of the people that are here. So our job is to share them. Where data comes in is helping us aim those stories at the right audiences. So visitor information allows us to segment and target in a way that makes sure that the right messages are reaching the right people and connecting with them. So at the same time, data also helps us articulate the impact of tourism. So I am a data guy. You probably heard that. So I like to be able to be in front of the legislature as well as any other group and be able to articulate to them what our economic capacity is for the tourism infrastructure and how the tourism ecosystem really everywhere touches everything. So when in Telluride was a really small footprint. So I was able to see it and feel it, that tourism touched everything in the community. And when you get into a larger community like Sullivan Catskills, you think to yourself, well, yeah, it doesn't really. And that's wrong. Tourism touches everything. Mm-hmm. You just have to figure out how and in what way. And tourism can lift everything as well.
And you mentioned the comparison between Telluride and Sullivan County, Telluride being sort of a smaller community, a smaller area. Sullivan County, as broad and big as Rhode Island,
yep.
And vast. Was there a particular time during your first few weeks so far that you started to feel like more of a connection to this community in this area?
You know, honestly, it started in the interview process. I did a ton of research on the search committee, and I really felt like the place itself felt like home to me. It wasn't, you know, so much, oh, I want to do this. It was like, this is going to be my home. Like and Telluride again, that was the first time that someone thanked me for what I was doing, because it was lifting the economy and it was lifting their ability to create a sustainable future. And that's what I've said about resort communities. Sullivan County is no different, that they're really built on three pillars. It's the community, the environment, and their sustaining will to create a sustaining future.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Michael Martillon, the new CEO of the Sullivan County Visitors Association. And we've been referring to the area as Sullivan Catskills, which some people refer to it, but some people say generically the Catskills. But Sullivan Catskills has been the brand. How do you look to update and evolve that brand? What do you want that to look like?
Well, you know, Sullivan County is really a kaleidoscope of special places, unique spaces, and extraordinary people. And because of that, we won't really be saying one thing. We'll be saying many things, many different things to many different people. So we'll be focusing on wrapping those experiences in ways that tap into emotive triggers, because at the end of the day, emotion drives every decision, including travel. So if we can connect with people on an emotive level, whether it's nostalgia or creativity or peacefulness, discovery, then our brand voice will be doing the job, reflecting the true riches of Sullivan Catskills and Sullivan. I mean, I tend to lean into Sullivan County because I want to. Catskills technically represents 20% of the county, and I know that's the brand because that's what it was in Telluride, and Mountain Village didn't like that we talked about Telluride all the time. But it is really, it's the whole county.
And you mentioned community, local government, businesses. What are the kinds of partnerships you want to continue to build with those areas, those folks?
Really partnerships that can articulate the economic impact. I want businesses to see growth, community groups to see culture and social benefits from tourism. So ultimately, I want to present a transparent picture of what the tourism ecosystem looks like and how it can lift everyone in the community.
Tourism changes fast. We have experienced that, of course, in this region, the Borscht Belt back in the day, change with the evolution of air travel. How do you make sure Sullivan Catskills, Sullivan County stays popular in the next 5 to 10 years with this rapidly changing environment when it comes to travel and tourism?
Yeah, and I think that what we're doing right now is actually going to lead to that. Having the developing a tech stack the way we're developing it. In my office, I've got this on the whiteboard, work in progress, and there are more than a dozen different trains we've got rolling at the same time. You'll see a couple in December. We'll have a brand new website from the ground up. You'll see a visitor guide for the first time that celebrates winter and spring rather than an annual visitor guide. And then we'll have another one for summer and fall. So we're building a data stack that forms a foundation of first-party data. That's another buzzword, but what that does, it allows us to speak to the consumer directly. So you don't have to spend so much money on second and third-party vendors that are claiming that they can help you reach that consumer. So we want to start to create relationships with consumers right now.
I know it's only been a couple months, but if you look ahead, what would you hope people say about the Sullivan County Visitors Association, Sullivan County, under your leadership?
The first thing I want them to say is we can't wait for the next 5 years. they've seen such commitment to the community, innovation, vision, and inclusion that there's real excitement around what's ahead. Like the grant, the collaborative grant program that we're working on with the county right now, I think is really going to be groundbreaking. And that would dedicate about $750,000 back into the community for different events, room generating efforts, chamber efforts, events, and cultural efforts.
Where can folks get more information to learn about what's going on at the Sullivan County Visitors Association?
Catskills.com, SullivanCatskills.com. And then, you know, go back in December. I mean,
you'll get an updated
website.
We've
got some Band-Aids right now, but in December, you'll get a brand new website from the ground up.
And before we go, how are you guys settling in? How's Very well. The family enjoying the return to the Northeast.
Well, my kids are, my son's in Denver, my daughter's in Boston, and we're in Manor, and we like Manor a lot. We're renting now. We don't really know where we're going to settle for keeps, if you will. But I'm just amazed at the environment and the gems that are just scattered all over the county.
That's Michael Martillon, the new CEO of the Sullivan County Visitors Association. More at SullivanCatskills.com. Thank you so much, and we look forward to partnering with you.
Thank you.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, as summer starts to wind down, Harmony in the Woods co-founder Jill Carletti talks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi about the last festival weekends coming up. This is Radio Chatskill.
The White House asked Congress to pull back federal funding for public media that had already been approved, and Congress has gone along. We want you to know that NPR and this station remain committed to informing the public, increasing your understanding of the world, and hopefully enriching your life in other ways. But without federal funding, we're relying on your support now more than ever. Please make your gift to this station today. Here's how.
Give now at WJFFradio.org. Thank you. Radio Catskills' Donna Fellenberg camped out at the original Woodstock Festival, and she did not like it. Her opinion of what camping is like there now is a little different.
I think it's fantastic. Like being at Woodstock, going from the site back to your tent where everything's wet. That's not going to be the occasion here.
Camping and glamping at Bethel Woods. Hear our exclusive report on the Woodstock Lost and Found podcast at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As summer starts its wind down, Harmony in the Woods is wrapping its season with two final weekends of music in nature. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi sat down with co-founder Jill Carletti to talk about the festival's founding and what audiences can expect this weekend and next.
Good morning, Jill Carletti, and welcome to Radio Chatskill.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
You're here to talk to us about Harmony in the Woods, about the events coming up and its history. So where should we begin?
Yeah, well, I think we could start a little bit in that this is our fifth season. Harmony in the Woods is an outdoor performing arts venue in plein air. And we are located in Holly, Pennsylvania, right on Route 6. And we showcase interesting acts, performers of some a variety of genres on Fridays and Saturdays, all throughout the summer, July and August. And sometimes we'll have a Sunday show, or sometimes we might have a show in September. But it's bring your own beverages and snacks and drinks, and we provide chairs, and we really are about making the experience kind of, we want it to feel magical when people arrive up at the top of the hill. You know, we provide golf carts for anybody that needs a lift, and our aim is really to create an appreciation of music and nature and togetherness. We've always we have a history before the woods, too, but we've been here at Harmony in the Woods for 5 years.
Well, tell us a little bit about that former history.
I'm an artist. I enjoy putting events together. Yeah, I just enjoy making things happen in the community. And it just happened to be serendipitous when I met Henry Skyer. And Henry Skyer wanted to initially to do something exciting in the boiler room of a Holly silk mill. And he wanted to do something arts related, but he wasn't quite sure. And anyway, long story short, we created together a performing arts space in the Holly silk mill. And over time it grew, and we really started off just very small with just, you know, showcasing, you know, maybe performers that were, had a gig in New York City and happened to be maybe on their way up on their tour. And, you know, we get them to come perform on weekends, and that was all year round. So
And what's that in the boiler room?
That was in the boiler room of the Holly Silk Mill, it's called. So it's a really cool space.
I remember it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really beautiful. It's like overlooks a waterfall. I mean, it's very nice. It used to indeed be the boiler room of the Silk Mill.
For those of our listeners that are not familiar with the Silk Mill in Holly, can you very briefly tell us what it is?
Yeah, well, the Holly Silk Mill was a silk factory, originally, and across the way where the Cocoon Coffee House now is, was where they housed the silkworms. So that was its original use. Over time, it became an antique dealership, and now. Today, it has a multitude of different shops and businesses. Once underwent a fire, really quite a lot to the Holly Silk Mill and its history.
Yes, it's interesting for folks to look up online about the Holly Silk Mill because it does have a fascinating history. Tell us a little bit about the events that are coming up.
Okay, well, we have just really 2 weekends remaining of our season, and our last 2 weekends will be featuring Tyler Reese Tritt. That's Travis Tritt's daughter, and she is doing a surprise country rock and pop music, and she's got really such a powerful, she's a powerhouse, and she's played before on the Harmony stage. So that's August 22nd, on Friday, August 22nd. And then we have August 23rd, Driftwood is a bluegrass Americana rock and roll fusion band. They have got a cult following and from this region. And that one's going to certainly be pop. Both of these groups have garnered a following in the area. And then we also have on August 29th, the following week, is Jeffrey Gaines, the vocalist who is famous for In Your Eyes. In your eyes, your eyes, your eyes.
Yes.
Yeah. so he's coming, and it's actually a co-bill. We really don't do this often, but this happened to just be a special opportunity to have Jeffrey Gaines and also the Josh Joplin group. So this is a co-bill. It's two different performers on the same night. They each are doing a set. So we have Jeffrey Gaines and we have Josh Joplin. And Josh Joplin is, you can kind of compare him maybe to a little bit of a Radiohead meets Ben Folds and eclectic. That's August 29th on Friday. So, and then for our final show, which is already sold out, but we have August 30th. Is Fleetwood Mac tribute called The Seven Wonders. And they're going to be doing all of the favorites from. So we're excited for all of these shows are going to be fantastic. They're coming up. We had quite a few tributes this summer. We had ABBA. We had an ABBA tribute called Mama Mania. We had a Billy Joel and Elton John review tribute. We've had a few, and they're always popular. But one of my favorite pieces of advice that one of our donors and greatest supporters has, I just love this. I agree with this so much. Is that you pick maybe a few of the things that are for sure you want to go see this tribute or maybe this other group you've heard of before. But then for everyone that he would pick like that, he then would always pick an experiment, and often find that he loves the experiment just as much or more than the for sure pick.
Well, that's a good strategy. Can you give the website?
Yes, it is harmonyinthewoods.org. Oh, important for rain. We basically watch the weather every day that we have a show. Between noon and one is when we will decide whether we're inside or outside. Well, the show goes on no matter what, but we will sometimes be inside depending on the weather.
Where is the indoor facility?
The indoor facility is located at, it used to be the old Rusty Palmer's restaurant on Route 6, at the junction of Route 6 and 652. It is now the Dime Bank Indian Orchard.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all this information, and I wish you some wonderful performances ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, we're excited. Every day is a fun adventure for our team, and it's all about the joy of music, of nature, and of enjoying all of that together.
And thank you to culture reporter Valerie Manzi, speaking to Jill Carletti at Harmony in the Woods. We'll take a break, and when we come back, they've been nurturing a love of birds for more than four decades. Now the Catskill Exotic Bird Club is tackling the challenges of conservation, one feathered friend at a time. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
With federal funding for public media eliminated, listeners all over this country are stepping up to support public radio. Hi, I'm Elsa Chang from All Things Considered.
And I'm Aisha Roscoe from Weekend Edition. We're here to share a little of what people are saying. Kyle in Brooklyn says, I'm skipping two lattes a month to keep Steve Inskeep in my ear each morning. We see you and thank you, Kyle.
Farouk in El Paso, Texas says, public radio is one of the key bloodlines of this country, keeping communities connected. Thank you, Farouk.
And Diane in Juneau, Alaska says, I'm so sorry this day has come. You have my support as long as I am able. Thanks, Diane.
If you have already made your gift to the station, or if you're a sustaining donor, seriously, thank you.
If not, please join the movement to protect public radio today and tell us why you're stepping up.
Here's how to donate, and thanks.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And just to add to some of those thoughts about public radio, locally, folks have been donating to us as well at WJFFradio.com. .org. Dean says, I remember a time before there was a radio Catskill. WJFF has made life in Sullivan County so much better in so many ways. Thank you so much for your comments and for your donation, Dean. And also Dan donating online and saying, I grew up in Beach Lake, Pennsylvania, and used to listen to local programming almost every morning going into school. The programs I listened to related to our natural environment, and they contributed to my career path in environmental restoration and conservation. And for that, I am forever thankful. And we are thankful for you, Dan, and for your donation, for everyone who's donated to help us during this time. You can show your support at WJFFradio.org, and please share your comments. Now, for 45 years, the Catskill Exotic Bird Club has brought together bird lovers across the Catskills. But as more bird species face the threat of extinction in recent decades, the club's mission has evolved. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Richie Cheeger, the president of the Catskill Exotic Bird Club, about the organization, and she brings us this audio postcard.
So, okay, why don't you tell me kind of who our friends are and what we're kind of looking at?
Oh, okay. Emma.
Hi, Emma.
You want to come out, Emma? Come on. Emma is 46, I think.
Okay. Richie Cheeger is holding one of his parrots, Emma, at his home in Monticello. Her feathers are mostly green, but she has a patch of yellow feathers that Cheeger says Amazon parrots develop as they get older.
Emma is an Amazon parrot, one of the larger Amazons, the Napes. They're about 15 inches long, full-bodied. They're green. Amazon parrots are basically green, but there are differences in the different species.
Cheeger is the president of the Catskill Exotic Bird Club. It's an association for bird lovers in the Catskills. At his home, it's clear he really loves animals. There is about 20 backyard chickens in his garden. He has two dogs, and there's a room dedicated to his love of elephants and birds. There are hundreds of photos and knickknacks of different elephants and his two parrots, Emma and Aristophanes.
Say hello. I always loved birds, always. And like I said, I always wanted a scarlet macaw. And then It was a few years after that. I used to go to the Prospect Park Zoo in Brooklyn all the time when they had elephants and parrots and, you know, and I actually used to go in the elephant's cage in the Prospect Park Zoo, which that was great. I can show you a picture of that. But they had a very big birdhouse at the Prospect Park Zoo, and they had a yellow-necked Amazon in the birdhouse. And I don't know. I just wanted it so badly, you know, and I got it. You know, I got Emma.
Years later, he and a few bird lovers here in the Catskills had the idea of starting a local bird club. That was in 1987.
And I said, you're going to find enough nuts, crazy people who want to have a bird club, you know, come on. And we did it. Matt, the one you spoke to, Matt Frumis, Matt put an ad in the paper that said, because Matt also had parrots, and he put an ad in the paper that said, bird lovers of the world unite. And we explained we're starting a bird club, and we did it. And it was the Catskill Exotic Bird Club.
But here's the thing. Exotic birds are a big trade industry around the world. Nearly one-third of all parrots are threatened with extinction due to habitat loss and collection, according to the Animal Welfare Institute. Cheeger says when he learned about the dangers of the pet industry more than 30 years ago, his views drastically changed.
I feel differently now. I love them. You know, I absolutely love them. But I don't feel they belong in cages. I don't feel they belong in homes. I feel that there shouldn't be any more breeding for the pet industry. That's how I feel. I mean, maybe a parakeet, you know, a little bird that could fly all over the house, a cockatiel even, you know, if you can let it fly all over the house and make it a part of your family. But these birds belong in the jungle. They belong flying free, and it's a big business.
At his home, Cheeger shows me his other bird, Aristophanes, a bright red neotropical parrot.
Aristophanes is, like I said, he's a scarlet macaw. They're about 36 inches long. They were the most popular macaws at one time. The bright scarlet red and with a band of yellow across the wing, and then the flight feathers on the wing are a royal blue, and the tail is bright red.
Was there like, because I think it's really interesting that your frame of thinking has changed over the years.
It really has.
Like, was there a moment or something that happened where you're like, okay, these birds shouldn't be in cages?
I think it's learning what really is going on in the wild, learning how the pet industry has just diminished the population of wild parrots to such a degree that it's terrible that just about every species except for a few are endangered species, and a very big part of that is being caught for the pet industry. I mean, there's other reasons too, but a very, very big part is the pet industry. Yeah. It's still done for other parts of the world. There are some countries where you can't bring in wild birds, but many you can.
Since then, Cheeger and his fellow bird club members have shifted their work to include the humane treatment of birds. That included advocating for the passage of the Wild Bird Conservation Act of 1992.
There was a law made in the United States. As a matter of fact, our bird club was one of the few bird clubs that pushed for the law, and that was that no more wild birds could be brought into the United States to be sold as pets. So whatever you're getting today and after that was birds that are born in captivity, you know. But the bad part of that is that they pull the baby bird from its mother and its father. And birds live in family groups, you know, and the parent birds go kind of nuts. Bella, don't do that. The parent birds go kind of nuts and they want their baby. So it's cruel.
If someone has had a pet bird for many, many years, right, and they decide, you know, maybe I want to set it free, is it too late?
You can't do that. Okay, it'll die. It'll starve. It'll be prey. Yeah, it'll be prey for hawks. It'll be prey for eagles, hawks, falcons. You know, any bird like that. You know, bird of prey.
Since its founding in 1978, the Catskill Exotic Bird Club has hosted more than 350 programs.
Like, how would you describe people's reaction to the birds?
Amazing. They love the birds. They absolutely love them. We'd go to old age homes. We took them to hospital programs, school programs, grown-up programs. And we would teach what it's like to have a bird as a pet, what's going on in the pet industry. We were very, very close with the curator of ornithology at the Bronx Zoo. And he loved us because we were a very humane-centered bird club. And as long as I'm running it, it's going to be humane. You know, somebody wants to be, industry-oriented? Enjoy it. I've had enough time, you know. But by me, it's got to be humane.
The Catskill Exotic Bird Club will host an educational bird event on October 12th at Cornell Cooperative Extension. They meet every second Thursday of the month in Monticello. In Monticello, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill.
And thank you for that, Kimberly. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Catskill. Before we go, a reminder that you can sign up for our free weekly newsletter. Stay connected and informed with the latest local news, culture, and more delivered to your inbox every Friday. Go to WJFFradio.org and sign up, and you'll get it this Friday in your inbox. And you'll also learn about some upcoming events we have this Labor Day weekend. Three opportunities to support public radio on Friday. Putt-Putt for Public Radio at Putt-Putt Van Winkle in Bovina. That's Friday the 29th from 5 to 7. Saturday the 30th at 10 a.m. It's our music yard sale right here at our Liberty Studios, where you can pick up some bargains. And then on Sunday, the 31st, it's Pints for Public Radio. It's at the Catskill Brewery in Livingston Manor. Free entry. Drink beer and support public radio. It's really that simple. Find out more at WJFFradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeffersonville Bake Shop, open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, and after-school snacks. Also featuring olive oil, ceramics, and other handmade items by artisan makers in Palestine.
This week on This American Life, a man and his car.
You know, like some people also like use the pronoun it for the car. I use the pronoun she for her. Like, and people say you are in a relationship with this car. So.
In the small community where he lives, this guy Ali has the only car, making him the unofficial taxi driver, delivery guy, and school bus driver. So what happens when his car makes an enemy?
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Minnetrongit was at the original Woodstock Festival in 1969. This summer, she returned for the first time in 56 years for a very special tour.
Everybody says, well, everybody was nude at Woodstock, right? And I'm like, no. I didn't really see that. I saw it in the movie. But no, it wasn't rampant.
This Woodstock anniversary weekend, take the tour with Minna on the Woodstock Lost and Found podcast at WJFFradio.org. Only from Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, clouds and a high of 72. Some clouds tonight and a shower later overnight, low of 57. If you thought today was cooler, wait until tomorrow. High of only 60 with periods of rain throughout the day and into the evening. Thursday, 66 for a high. Clouds and a sunny, pleasant weekend, 77 Friday and Saturday, 73 on Sunday. On Point is next.
Support comes from Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and grill on Main Street in Jeffersonville, featuring local American fare, Saturday and Sunday brunch, and Thursday trivia nights. Menu and hours online at tavernonmainny.com.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.